Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 19th of Sivan. Today we're going to discuss with Cook about a husband and a get and problems that arose in that situation. It's from Shut Ezra Kohen and Yene Evan Ezra Simon Pei Bet, their 82nd responsum. It's from the 19th of Sivan of Tuf Resh Ayin Bet of 1912. We have to remember to thank the OU and to Rabbi Jack Abramowitz and David Hochhauser for their help in putting together these shiurim and having them go online. So he's writing to Rav Cook is writing to Rav Chaim Berlin. Rav Chaim Berlin was by this time an elderly man and a well-known rav, a well-known and very well-respected rabbi who was very much towards the end of his life. In fact, he was at the exact end of his life. He was 80 years old at this point, and this was the year that he passed away. He had moved to Yerushalayim 6 years earlier. He's a son of the Netziv, and he's in himself a very important Rav. So Rav Cook is writing to Rav Chaim Berlin. They apparently were working together on a get case, and it's Al Dvar. He writes about Al Dvar Hamagen Yaakov Yitzchak. The husband's name is Yaakov Yitzchak. Rav Cook says, to my great distress, I found out that he, not only is he not giving his wife a get in the way that we think he needs to give her a get and doing what he's supposed to do, he actually already got married again, even though I warned him very strongly in no uncertain terms that he can't even get engaged, he can't even like date women, as it were, until he settles this issue with his wife. But he didn't do it, and he found Rabbanim who weren't like thinking so carefully, weren't thinking so deviously, and he showed them his Ketav Petur. So the Ketav Petur, he had a Rav in New York who wrote him a Ketav, a document, that said, now it said that he had already divorced his wife, when as we're going to see, it's not true that he already divorced his wife. It's true that he had already authorized divorcing his wife, but the wife isn't yet divorced because there's going to be problems. Because it turns out the wife seems to be in Koslovich, which is where actually later, like a year after this, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik would become the Rav, and that would be Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who many of us know as the Rav from YU, grew up in Koslovich. So the get focuses on Koslovich issues. So he found the Rav in New York. And the Rav in New York writes for him that he's already divorced his wife. He brings that writ. Even the Rav Cook has told him, you're not allowed to get married to anybody. You're not allowed to even date anybody. You're not allowed to get engaged to anybody. He shows it to some Rav who didn't know what was going on. And that Rav, that rabbi, allowed him to marry a woman to get married. So he's married already. Not only did he have that thing that he was already divorced, he also had found the court in Yerushalayim that it said that he was right about the monetary issues. So he might be right about the monetary issues, but that doesn't, even if he's right about the monetary issues, it doesn't mean that he has the right to get married again until such time as the case is settled. So if Cook is trying to say, you got to settle the case, and before you can get married again, you have to divorce your wife in a way that she's actually divorced, and you have to settle everything and everything has gotten rid of, and that's not what happened. He got married again, even though he wasn't supposed to. So if Cook is upset about that, and he's expressing his distress about that to Rav Chaim Berlin. So Rav Cook says he's all upset about this. He's spoken harshly to the man and saying the man's in permanent violation of the Chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom until and unless he fixes this, but the man doesn't apparently care that much. So he's sitting there upset. He gets a letter from Rav Chaim Berlin about the get. It turns out the get, the writ of divorce, is in Koslovich, and he doesn't know what to do about it. So apparently it got to Koslovich, meaning it seems like this man had been in New York, had sent the get to Koslovich where his wife was, and then come to Israel and was causing problems in Israel. So the rabbi in Koslovich now has problems with the get. So he doesn't explain, Rav Cook says, he didn't properly and fully explain to me it didn't explain really why there was a need for a new shlichut. Apparently, the Rav in Koslovich wrote to him that something had wrong, and they needed a new authorization of a messenger. Remember that gittin can be done by messenger, so the husband just needs to appoint a messenger to bring the get. That's fine. But something had gone wrong with the previous messenger. It's not clear what it was, and therefore they need a new messenger. So, but the Rav didn't explain why. So he doesn't explain if it's because they lost or got destroyed the Shtar Shlichot HaRishon, the document that declared the Shlichot, that declared that he was appointing somebody to be a messenger to deliver the get to his wife, or that the Shliach himself passed away or went somewhere, or that maybe the whole get had been sent without getting a firm written commitment that he could have a harshah of the shlich, so you have a permission to have a messenger. So the reason why you need to know that is because you need to know how to react. So for example, sort of a cook, I need to understand about the people who put the get together, meaning the Shlichut HaGet was sent from New York. It's not that he went through Jerusalem. None of this had happened through Israel until now. What happened was he was in New York. He sent the get to his wife in Chaslamich. Then he came to Israel. And so now he's in Yerushalayim and he's Rav Kook's problem. But when the Rav in Chaslamich says we have a problem with the authorization of the messengers to deliver the get to the wife, he doesn't play what it is. And the reason why that's important, says Rav Kook, is because I'm not sure I trust these New York rabbis, and he doesn't name them, but I'm not sure I trust these New York rabbis about whether they know how to write a get in general. Because if they don't know how to write a get in general, then we're not allowed to trust their get. We've seen this another occasion. We had a case of Rav Vaid Yosef being asked about a rabbi in Italy as to whether you can trust the rabbi who wrote the get. You need to know the rabbi, because if you don't know how to write a get, then we can't trust that you did it right, even though it looks relatively right to us. So that's the whole question. So here he says, I have some doubts about it. The reason I have some doubts about it is, first, remember we said the husband was already in possession of a ketav p'tur. He was already in possession of a writ, of a document that said he had, now what it should have said is he had written a get to his wife, which is not the same as having divorced his wife. But instead, the Rav in New York wrote, and Rav Kook says, I don't know who this Rav is, wrote that he divorced his wife, right? So that's not true. So once he's inaccurate about that, it might mean he doesn't understand the mechanics of this process, and that would already cause me some worry. But beyond that, Rav Kook says, you know, the whole form, the whole way that it's written in the Ptur, meaning he doesn't see the get himself, Rav Kook, the get's in Chaslavich. But he says, the whole document that I did see, which says this man divorced his wife, aside from the fact that it says divorced as opposed to wrote a bill of divorce, it's got other problems too. And if those problems were in the get itself as well, then the get itself would be problematic. It might be possible, might be invalid. And then the fact that the Rav Chaslavich is sending me to say, you need to send a new shlichut get, you need to send a new document that says the husband appoints a messenger to deliver the get, we might need more than that. We might need to rewrite the get, because if the get is invalid, then you need to rewrite a new get. So what are the problems with it? And he says, now each of the problems that I'm raising are not necessarily deep problems that invalidate the get themselves, but they might be enough to show that the person writing the get didn't know what he was doing, and if the person writing the get doesn't know what he was doing, then the get is invalid and you have to write it again, because get needs to be right by those expert in them, not just by somebody who happens to get it right, or that we haven't discovered the thing they got wrong. So even if I found out that it's just that he wasn't careful, the Rav in New York wasn't careful about the way he wrote the Ptur, this document that said the husband has fulfilled his responsibilities, but once you see those kinds of problems, you have to look into you have to look into what's going on. You have to figure out whether or not maybe he got it wrong in the get itself as well. So for example, it says in this document that this is going to be a proof or evidence that in the hands of the husband, Yitzchak Yaakov, that's what it says, when his real name was Yaakov Yitzchak. So they flipped it. Ben Moshe Menachem, and it doesn't say that he was called, the father was actually called Moshe Mendel. So these are examples of mistakes that the Rav writing the letter, writing the document, seems to have made in terms of how to write the names. And that gets to be a problem. And getting themselves certainly gets to be a problem. And then it writes, and this is going to be the one that Rav Kook is going to spend even more time on, Shigerish Ishto Ranya Bat Aryeh Leib. So Ranya is a name we'll get to later in the tshuva, but right now Aryeh Leib, the Leib part of the tshuva, of the name, he wrote it with two yuds, Lamed Yud Yud Bet, Leib, whereas the custom in Europe and in Rav Kook, that Rav Kook knew in Yerushalayim, was to spell the name Leib, Lamed Yud Bet, with one Leib, with one yud. And then it says, Hamechune Leib, right? So the first they wrote his name was Aryeh Leib. Then they said, who's known as, Amechun is like, who's known as, who's called Leib HaLevi, who's called Leib the Levi. Now, that means that this Rav didn't know the simple halacha that when we call somebody in these kinds of documents, a Kohen or a Levi, we write it after the original name before the kinoi, before the name that he's called. Meaning, if this man's name is Aryeh Leib, who's known just as Leib, then he should have written Aryeh Leib HaLevi, who's known as Leib. Ella shebemet ta'abi kar davar shekhtav hamechune. It's also true that you shouldn't have written hamechune. Hamechune is who has a nickname, and that's a completely other name is what hamechune is supposed to mean. Whereas this guy had written Aryeh Leib, who's mechune Leib, but mechune can't apply to Leib because Leib is a name that's already been mentioned. That's not mechune. Who's Dimit Kari is another way of saying it, who's also called. But the fact that he mentioned Leib twice shows also he doesn't understand the writing of names, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to write Mitkare Leib, who's known as Leib. Now, I want to say, that I found many tshuvot that I haven't shared in this venue. And these guys, I think I haven't even read them because they get very technical, as you can see. But part of the point to recognize, to understand, is that this one, when it's getting technical, this is crucial to understanding and to being able to be sure that this rabbi in New York knew how to write a get properly, knew how to write a bill of divorce properly, and to know that this woman in Khaslavich is divorced, which would then free this man in Jerusalem to marry and to stay with his second wife. But once we see that he doesn't know about the lab, then, so if he doesn't know how to write lab properly, he doesn't know a lot of things. But in addition, if he had written Demitkri lab, then there would have been room to say that maybe you put the Levi before the second name, because nobody calls him Leib HaLevi, right? He's not known in the streets as Leib HaLevi. He's called HaLevi when he comes up to the Torah. So there he's probably called Aryeh Leib HaLevi. So some people would say, yeah, you have to write Aryeh Leib HaLevi, Dmitri Leib. Or maybe we can say that since they're separate names, and they're not kinuyim, they're like versions of a name, you can put Levi at the end, then it should be okay. So there are a lot of people on either side of that question, right? So he says, here in our Beis Din in Yerushalayim, our practice is to write HaLevi Basof in that situation. If you have Aryeh Leib Dmitri Leib, because it's only you say Mechune, when it's a completely different name, that's where you make the mistake, and that's what he holds. But you might think that he's just Mechune HaLevi, he's called HaLevi, he's an actual Levi. So that's what we write. In a Mitkri case, since you don't have to worry, since it's all part of the same name, it's just different versions of the same name, you can put the Levi way at the end. Because even if somebody said Leiva Levi, then they would know that he's Levi, because they wouldn't think they'd just call that, because Mitkri means it's just part of the versions of the name. And it's well known, he says, Rav Cook says, it's well known. So always what other people think of as well known strikes me, because there are things that, you know, I've never known, and people say it's well known, and I sometimes hear myself saying it, I feel bad about it, because just because I happen to know something, I always think if I happen to know it, it's probably well known, but maybe it's not always true. So there's a Shach in Choshen Mishpat, Mem Tet. Chapter 49, Steve Cotton Ted Vav, in his 15th comment. So I'm skipping much of the Shach. I looked up the Shach. He doesn't quote the whole Shach. I looked up the Shach because I had no idea what he's talking about. And but the Shach's conclusion is, if you have two people named Yosef ben Shimon and Asir, remember, before you have last names, and even today with last names, you can still have it, although it's somewhat less so. But, you know, I remember years ago, there was a gathering, they used to have a club called the Jim Smith Club. I think it was Jim Smith Club, and they had like 850 Jim Smiths or more in it, some of them being women, right? So you can get people with the same names. It can get complicated. So the Gemara has that version of it. Shnei Yosef and Shimon in one city, right? If you have two men named Yosef and Shimon in a city, and then you have a shtar, and this is not only talking about a divorce issue, let's say you have a regular shtar, a regular document, a loan or a sale, right? And it's written Yosef and Shimon, and then it has Nun Reish, which means Natrech Rachmana, O Shalit, Shin Lama Yud Tav, which is their version, the earlier version of Shlita, which we have today, Meshayichia Leorch Yamim Tovim, right? So if you have those names attached too, it says Yosef and Shimon, and the abbreviation that means they're still alive, wish them well, comes at the end of the name. So the Shach says, if the father, if either one of them is alive, you can't use this shtar, because maybe the Natri Rechmana or the Shalit means, I was talking about the Yosef, not about the Shimon, meaning you might have said, Chizalah. That'll show me, if one of their fathers is alive, one is no longer alive, you might have thought the one that you have, the Natri Rechmana or the Shlita after the name of the father, maybe you'll tell me that shows that it's the father who's alive. But the answer is no. Because if you're referring to the guy as Yosef ben Shimon, you think of him as Yosef ben Shimon, then that might have been that the Sofer, the scribe who wrote the document, when he used the word Natri Rechmana, the Hashem should protect him, or Sheyich Leoch Yamim Tovim, that he should live a long and you know, a long life. So maybe that was really referring to the Yosef, and the fact that it's here doesn't mean anything, and therefore you can't use that as a proof about which Yosef and Shimon you have, and therefore you can't collect the document. Meaning, when you have a document where the protagonist of the document is somebody is not clear, then you have a challenge, you have a problem. The thought was, maybe in this case, you could find a way to prove who we were talking about, because only one father was alive, and the alive words seem to be applying to the father. The answer is no, you can't do that. That's what the Shach says. You can't rely on that, because you might have written at the end, just because you got used to writing at the end. That'll apply to the Halevi as well, but it shows, Ubeget, in Yesh Kinu La Ben Velo La Av, if there's something that the son is called, not the father, then you should write Ploni, HaMechune Ploni Ben So-and-so, meaning the get, you should write so-and-so, and then you write the other name, and then you write the father's name, to avoid that problem. And then the Shach says, and if you wrote Ploni Ben Ploni, HaMechune Ploni, then it's possible, because it sounds like the father is the one who has that other name, not the son. So, However that works, like what he refers to that shock, and the point is, he says, Rav Kook says, that with all of these problems, and it really seems like, so he says he thinks it's better to write a new get, and then, and this is kind of a subtle move on his part, he says, even though the reason that you, Rav Chaim Berlin, he says he doesn't refer to him directly, he refers to him in the third person, not mitame demar, the reason of Mar, the reason of, you know, Rav Chaim Berlin, what his reason was, Mashelo Katav Hazman Hamakom Velo Ha'edim. It doesn't say in the document, this Ptur, this document, this writ that says the husband has done what he needs to do, it doesn't say the time, it doesn't say the place it was written, it doesn't say who the witnesses were. So he says, Yesh Lomar, you could say that since in Chaslavich they know that they only got one get from New York, from this Migaresh to this woman, so let's remember, right, what's the case? How often do you think it happened in Chaslavich in 1912 that a husband who had gone to New York was sending a writ of divorce to his wife back in Chaslavich? Probably not so often. So Rav Kook is saying that that might be an argument to say that even if the document has been executed without many of the important identifying details, it doesn't necessarily invalidate it because everybody knows which it is. It's like a simon muvhak. It's like a well-established sign. And the halacha is that if you have a well-established sign of something, then it can be valid as a document. Dugma. There's an example of that in the Gemara in Bava Metzia about a shtar, where if the witnesses say, about a get, about a bit of divorce, if the witnesses say, we have never signed any get written by Yosef ben Shimon other than for this man, meaning we find a get signed by these witnesses, and it's for Yosef ben Shimon, we don't know which Yosef ben Shimon it is, there's no identifying characteristics. If the witnesses come and say, we've never signed a get for any Yosef ben Shimon other than this one, that seems to be okay. So that part of it, so basically what he's saying is, very politely, what he's saying is, your idea doesn't work, right? That's not a problem, but there are reasons why I think it's a problem, why I think we should rewrite the get. For example, we have the custom that any get that's sent by mail to actually appoint two messengers. We have a whole, because the mail was a problem because there are non-Jews handling the item in between. There's all question halacha about the extent to which a non-Jew can be a shaliach, can be a messenger or not. So because of all those problems, our custom is to appoint two messengers. The first messenger is in front of the husband, who stands there when the get is written and signed and can verify, that I saw it written, I saw it executed. And then that first guy appoints in front of the Beit Din another shliach in place of the woman. And the second one says, I am a shliach of Beis Din, I am a messenger of the court. And then can accept it on behalf of the woman. So the problem with that is, right, and we send them both together. So they can both say, I saw it written. The first one is the messenger of the husband. The second one can become the messenger of the Beis Din. And therefore, there's nobody in between, I think, is the issue that you're having here. But that the Baal should do it here in Jerusalem, the husband should do it here, or do it in New York, it's not going to help us at all because he can't say, before I saw it written, I saw it signed. And it's also what's called mile, it's called words. And words, it's unclear that when it comes to just ideas, that you're allowed to be able to appoint a shliach unless you have something actually written, some actual physical, tangible item in your possession, then you can't make a shliach for the gerush. So for all those reasons, he thinks, including now, he says, the primary time they were close, of course, you and your idea as well. So even though I think that your idea doesn't quite work, but we shouldn't go ahead and let her and have a get, ignoring you completely, ignoring your reason completely. It's better that we need to write a new get. Especially this is a matter of an HSC, it's a matter of a married woman, right? So that we have that problem. So therefore, it's most appropriate to write a new get. And to write a new get, we need more information from the Rav in Chaslavich, right? We're coming back to why these things can take a long time. We need a new get, and we need to find out some information. Here's the information. For example, the Rav in Chaslavich had written in his letter, the name of the wife is Ranya Bat Reb Aryeh Leib HaLevi. So it doesn't say, the Rav Chaslavich doesn't tell us if this man was also called Leib alone, or just Aryeh Leib, or maybe when they call him to the Torah, they call him Aryeh Leib, right? So, but everybody else calls him the two names together, and we don't know that, right? So that's one issue that he needs to know. And then I'm even more surprised by the letter, because he wrote Ranya, But Aryeh Halevi HaMechun Halev. So that's not Aryeh Halev, it's Aryeh HaMechun Halev. So now I don't know anything about what he is. Is it that his name was just Aryeh, but people called him Leib, and then that's what you have to do? And Chaim Berlin didn't tell me how he knows the answer to these questions, and how we know that it's one name or two names. So those things I need to know before we could rewrite the get in order to have the husband appoint a messenger to send the get to Chaslavich. And then he writes, so this whole question of two names or one name, and how you know and what you care about, it's been there's a lot of discussion about it already. He says among those oskim b'miktzoa ze shel shmot gitin, who are involved in this profession of writing git. It's an actual skill. It's a body of knowledge. It's a knowledge base. It's an issue, and there are people who work on it. If you don't work on it, you don't know it. And I think this isn't the only example, but there are many examples today where people just sort of assume that topics are a lot easier than they in fact are, and how much expertise do you need? When it comes to writing names in Gittin, it's not so simple at all. Another problem, that's the Aryeh Halev problem with the two names, or the one name and what he was really called. Another problem was the Rav in Chaslavich had written the name Ranya with two yuds in it. Resh Aleph Nun, Yud Yud Aleph, Ranya. Right? But he doesn't know, so he wants to know. Rav Kook says, I don't need to know. Is that really how she writes her name? He should have told us, because the name that we know, I think of Ranya, which is how I'm pronouncing it, is usually written Resh Nun Yud Aleph, not Resh Aleph Nun Yud Yud Aleph, right? So why is that a problem? Because the way that he wrote the Resh Aleph Nun Yud Yud Aleph is usually written as Run, is usually pronounced as Ranya, with a chirik under the nun, an ethan under the nun, and a kamatz under the yud, Ranya. So if that's what he meant, then fine. But the name Ranya or Ranya would be spelled without all of that. So I don't know what to do about that. And that's an important thing, because it makes a difference in the way their name is pronounced. And if I have to write the get, knowing the proper name, proper way to write this woman's name. He says, so I think it's probably true that her name is Ranya Resh Nun Yud Aleph, and they just chose to write it. He just sort of messed it up, the writing of it. But I can't, based on what I think, just write it again, because I need to know the right spelling of it, and it might create a psul, because if you write it the wrong way, it's pronounced a different way, and then you have that problem. Now, it is true, he says, that in the beginning of the letter, he wrote Ranya Resh Aleph Nun Yud Aleph, so that's just one yud like we are. That would be Ranya, right? Not Ranya, but Ranya. But afterwards, he wrote it twice with the two yuds, and the problem is, we also have a principle, just remember, halachic principles that apply to sort of a lot of situations, you have to apply then to the specific example you have in front of you. When he writes it down at the bottom, especially when it's lama'aseh, when it is the practical example of, he writes the name and then he's closing up the letter to say, if we're closing up the letter to say, this is what happened, he writes the name of the woman, the name of the man, we usually halachically follow the latest iteration of the name, right? There's a paragraph in Choshen Mishpat, chapter 42, paragraph 6, and this is talking about documents in general, not just Gittin. If, let's say, in the bottom part, some part of it was scraped off, one letter is missing. So if one letter is missing, you're allowed to judge the bottom part by the top part. How does that work? So for example, let's say the bottom had said that the top says that so-and-so owes money or borrowed money from Hanani, right? Hanani. And then the bottom it says Hanan, Chet Nun Nun. So it's missing the yud. So the fact that it's missing one yud is not a big problem, because we can say, yeah, but the top part can inform us as to how to act in the bottom, how to understand the bottom part. But the halacha is that if it's two letters that are missing, then we won't do it. So for example, let's say it wrote in the top of the shtar, you wrote Hanani, and in the bottom it just wrote Chen or Chan, Chet Nun. You can't learn it. You'd have to assume that the bottom one is the word that we're looking for, and you'd have to find some guy Chan, otherwise you couldn't collect on that shtar. So that would mean then that the shtar is invalid, and you can't collect anything, because it's an invalid shtar. They're out of sync, the two names, we have no information in the shtar. So that shows that the later part really is the important part, even though you could learn from the top part. But if the later part is more exacting about it, then you would seem to think that way. So that's a question here. It seems like he wasn't being careful, and therefore he wrote one or two of the names without being particularly careful with them. But it seems like in the next version of it, we have to tell him we need to have a more exact, a pronunciation of the name. We have to be sure about how you write this name, so that we can have it not only in like documents for money, but certainly when we're talking about a get, when it's talking about freeing a woman in terms of her not being caught forever, stuck forever without ability to get married again, and him having to not violating the Chayim Debrina Gershom, then we can't just trust him, and we have to We have to work this out. Another issue is the husband is claiming that she's an ilonit, that she is somebody who physically is unable to have children, and he wants that to be therefore say that he doesn't owe her the ketubah, the usual financial commitments that husbands make to wives when they get married, because he says, because I was misled, because I didn't know that she was an ilonit, she was physically unable to have children, and therefore I want out of this and I won't have to pay. So the there on that topic, says Rav Cook, there's two different parts to a ketubah. Nowadays, our ketubot are pretty pro forma, but even within those ketubot, you have a part that was the halacha in the Torah, let's say, I think, 100 zuz, and then you have the tosefet ketubah, which the husband voluntarily adds to. Now, that word voluntary is a little exaggerated because in our day, it's just a form. But in any case, since it's theoretically a voluntary addition, so there we would say he's obligated anyway, even if you claim that she was an island, he's physically unable to have children, he didn't know. But we think that the Tosefet is given with such free will and such interest that it doesn't matter if it turns out to be wrong. He just plans to give this money to her as a free will gift no matter what. Especially since we can say that maybe she didn't know she was an ilonit either, and if she didn't know, she wasn't fooling him. But the central ketubah, the 100 zuz, so there, if he didn't know, we can't make him pay it because he didn't know what was going on here. So, and he's clearly going to claim that he didn't know. So therefore, you're going to have a problem monetary, the monetary issues, right? He's going to claim he doesn't owe her anything. Rav Cook thinks he's going to owe her the tosef, whatever it was, but the central ketubah, the central amount, that he probably won't owe her because he can claim he didn't know what he was getting into, and therefore he can say that he doesn't have to pay it. Except that you might say there's another issue. In Evan Ezra, in the Beit Shmuel, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, in Kuftet Zayin, paragraph 7, he says, what happens if somebody lives with the wife after he already recognized whatever the problem was? This comes up today in other issues where people want to claim a kiddush etel. People want to claim that they were misled about a marriage. So it comes up in there as well. So let's say he's claiming he was misled. So there he says, but he lived with her after he found out already she was an ilonit. We can nonetheless say that he wasn't sure if that was enough to allow him get out of the marriage, and that's why he stayed with her. He thought he was stuck, because sometimes in halacha, we would say, especially about like this issue, there's a lot of ways that you can tell whether a woman is an islander or not. The question is one of the ways good enough? So in this case, she seems to have had one of the ways that I just don't feel like getting into, because it's not necessary to talk about, but there are some ways that are more significant than others. So he had discovered a way that the Chasam Sofer, as it happens, had thought was a very, very significant way, that she wasn't, let's say it this way, she wasn't developed at all in the chest. So he thought that was one, but he might have thought that he needed all of the ways the Gemara lists, and therefore he thought he was stuck because he couldn't prove that she was an island, and that might be why he stayed with her. If that's why he stayed with her, then, says Rav Cook, it's not, in fact, evidence that he meant to forego his right to get out of it. Now, I think this is important information. Rav Cook is not talking about Kiddush HaTos directly, but it comes up with the discussion of Kiddush HaTos today. Many times today, you'll hear people who say that if someone was married under false pretenses, they'll say, well, but if he lived with her afterwards, it's like he was willing to forego it. But I think sometimes that person didn't realize they had the right to get out of the marriage just for those reasons, and that's why they stay in the marriage. That could be true for a man or for a woman, and I think that's an important issue, but it doesn't come up here. But in any case, here, this guy, if he can feasibly claim he didn't know he had his way out of it, then he doesn't maybe have to pay the ketubah because he never was mochel. He never said, yeah, I'm willing to live with this way. He didn't know what his rights were. And since he didn't know what his rights were, that's where it ended up. And then even if other people will say, we don't know for sure that she has the signs of it, as long as he says he's sure of it, that's good enough for him to claim that he wants out and he never meant to make this financial commitment that he had. Now, all of that then, says Rav Cook, is ledina. That's a strict halacha. Aval, al kol pan al v'apiat tzedek v'hayosher. So there's halacha, and then he says a tzedek hayosher. That's what I said already. That by, you know, if he's going to do things the proper, correct way, if he's going to be nice to her and just with her and do things like a fine person should do, he should find a way to appease her financially. And then when we can put together a get, we'll put together a get, and we'll get the names right. We'll do all the things right, and we'll hope that therefore we'll find compromise where everybody can walk away as well as possible. It's obviously a very sad situation because we find out by the end of the letter that she was an ilonit. She had all these physical problems, so she's not going to have any time getting married to anybody else. He's abandoned her. He fled to New York. Now he's in Israel. He's already remarried. So the question is, this is what Rav Kook is saying to Rav Chaim Berlin, let's hope we can put this all together and separate them as well as we can and let him give her something to try to appease her and let her feel better. And since you've started, Rav Chaim Berlin, you started with this, if you can get into contact with the Rav and Chislavich and figure out the names, we'll put it all together and I'll appreciate it and we'll put it all together. So that is an example of what happens sometimes when things get complicated with putting together weddings. An example from the 19th of Sivan of Tuf Resh Ayin Bet of 1912 from Rav Kook. With thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Roman, David Hochhauser, I bid you a good day for the 19th of Sivan.